Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of this show. Newman is in Wichita, Kansas, where I've lived for, 20 years or so. And when I moved out to Wichita, I was a little bit surprised to find out that people in Wichita think of themselves as living in the Midwest. In fact, of course, at least for most of American history, this was the West, or at least the gateway to it. And I've been surprised to find out that I actually know precious little about what people in the United States often called the Indian Wars, which happened at least a little bit, not that far away from Wichita. So I'm greatly looking forward to talking with Edward Westerman today. Ed teaches history at Texas A&M at San Antonio. He's by training an expert in military history, and particularly European history, and is the author of a well-regarded book on the German police battalions on the Eastern Front in the Second World War. In his new book, he turns his attention to comparative history, Hitler's Ostkrieg and the Indian Wars, Comparing Genocide and Conquest, was published by Oklahoma University Press in 2016. It examines the Holocaust and the conflicts in the American West in the 19th century to see what we can learn about these conflicts in particular, and more generally, about genocide as a phenomenon. It's a book full of careful analysis and thoughtful discussion, and I have to say, I learned a lot from it, especially about the conflicts in my own region. Looking forward to digging into the discussion with Ed, and so with that, Ed, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Well, thank you, Kelly. It's glad to be here and have the opportunity to talk about the project.
So I always start by asking people to say a little bit about their background, and so maybe you can say a little bit about who you are and how you became an academic.
Yeah, Kelly, I definitely did not have what would be the typical academic background. I graduated from the Air Force Academy, and I was a history major there, but I ended up actually becoming a pilot in the Air Force and spent about 25 years in the Air Force. But fortunately, I was able to actually get two graduate degrees, a master's degree at Florida State, and my PhD at UNC Chapel Hill. And along the way, the Air Force let me go do a Fulbright fellowship in Berlin and some research grants I was able to take in Germany and at the Holocaust Museum. So history for me has always been my passion. And it's always been something I've felt very strongly about. So as when I actually retired from the military, I was very fortunate to get a job at Texas A&M San Antonio, as you mentioned, and really enjoyed teaching there as well.
You said you got your degree at North Carolina, and I know from talking to you just a moment ago that you worked with Dick Cone and Gerhard Weinberg there. Those are real giants in the field of military history. Can you say something about your experience working with them?
I guess what I'd said is I had Alex Rowland from Duke, Dan Biddle from Duke, Melissa Bullard from UNC, Conrad Jarosz, and as you said, Gerhard Weinberg and Dick Cone. I always make the joke it took six of the best minds in the world to get me through a PhD program. So, it's kind of obviously one of the things that you learn at a program like that with the resources that are available there is it sharpens your ability as a young academic to think about history, to think about the interrelationships of history. Methodological diversity is something else you get out of that type of program. As you mentioned, I was a dual major in terms of European history and military history both. And so I think some of that broadness that you get in exploring other disciplines within the historical discipline, sub-disciplines, gives you greater insight into your own discipline. And that's kind of what I very much found in doing the comparative work on the American West and the Nazi East as well, that the reciprocal insights that you get from looking at other periods of history and other times is really intellectually very satisfying and challenging in many respects as well.
So did you always did you intend from entering grad school to do work on mass atrocities, or did you kind of evolved to that point?
Well, what happened was I was an exchange pilot with the German Air Force for 3 years. So I went to language school And when I, at the end of that 3-year period, I had wanted to go back and teach at the Air Force Academy. So they sponsored me for my first degree. And I ended up at Florida State, actually, with Alan Steinweiss, who's now at the University of Vermont, as the Hilberg endowed professor there. But Alan, as a German historian who'd also gone to UNC and worked with Gerhard there, had talked to me about, well, what is it you want to do? And initially I had thought something about military history in general, German military history, to take advantage of the language background. And I started looking at the police, and this was before Chris Browning's book came out. And as it turned out, that the more I started looking at the police, the more I saw, not in contrast to like the SS that typically people know about, the Gestapo, just ordinary policemen were involved in genocide and genocidal actions and conquest in the East. And so that kind of took off from there. My interest in the Holocaust actually grew out of that and just kind of kept expanding over the next 2.5 decades.
So why the American West? Why choose that as a companion piece to the Holocaust for this book?
Well, what I was struck by is in the book, as you remember, Hitler at different times, at varying times, made this comparison himself about that his conquest in the East was essentially a template for what had been done in the American West. And I always found that comment interesting because Hitler read a lot, but he was not what we would call intellectual, and he borrowed the great majority of his ideas from others. And when it comes to Western history, Karl May, obviously the Winnetou series, was Hitler was an avid reader of that, and I knew that. And so I started to think, well, how much did Hitler really know about the American West? How appropriate is that comparison? And in talking to some of my colleagues within the field of Holocaust studies, we often, you know, students in the classroom who make these comparisons. And so what was interesting to me is to go ahead and explore that comparison really at the empirical level in a way that would allow me to satisfy my own intellectual curiosity, but also to be able to engage with the students in the classroom. And the complexity of these stories, I think, for me, is what's also very interesting.
So I thought that in looking at this book, my guess is that people are less familiar with the Indian Wars of the West than they are with the Holocaust. And so let's start talking with that. And first, a note about terminology. I'm using the terminology you've used in the book, and just to be clear to everybody, and I think that makes sense. And so we'll talk about Indians in the Indian Wars, and we will talk about Americans in America as the United States and citizens of that. I know that I've been taken to task occasionally by foreign students in South America who complain about my use of Americans, and perhaps rightly so. So for this, just laying up for ease of use, we'll use those two terms. And to start the discussion, you talk about the idea of manifest destiny, of serving as a framing narrative for American expansion. For those people who are not familiar with this, what is this idea, and why did it emerge, and what is the kind of imagined goal of this manifest destiny?
Yeah, and if I could, just to
back
up, the way that I wanted to do the comparison, and I think this starts, this will get, I'll fall back on your original question, just by explaining, in doing the comparison, I felt I needed a structure to understand this comparison. So the way I built that structure was to start with national philosophies of conquest, and in the case of manifest destiny for the United States, certainly, was one for Nazi Germany, Lebensraum or living space was the other. The second part of that structure was national policies of race and space. So looking at the role of government and non-governmental agencies in these processes. The third part of this was military strategies in both areas. Then the fourth chapter looks at massacre and atrocity and the way it's used in both areas. And then finally, the last chapter looks at what would be guerrilla war in the U.S. Southwest New Mexico Territory, Arizona Territory, and the anti-partisan war in the East. So having said that, that was the way I was going to try to conduct an empirical study. Now, getting back to Manifest Destiny as an overall, overarching national philosophy, certainly it's understood in the 1840s is the idea that America, the United States, needs to be a coast-to-coast empire. So, in fact, when we're talking about Oregon Territory, when we're talking about Texas, when we talk about the Mexican-American War and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which essentially creates this enormous new Western territory that's now part of the United States, the idea that there's a messianic type of view that the United States needs to expand from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast, and in that messianic view, that zeitgeist or the spirit of the times at that time sees it as a civilizing Christianizing kind of philosophy that is going to bring light to the darkness, literally. And those who are familiar with Gast's picture of Columbia literally striding in the light to bring light and knowledge to the West, it kind of defines Manifest Destiny, at least in that period. One of the points that I would make about Manifest Destiny, however, is it's an amorphous, in some cases plastic, type of term because it's redefined, because it's around for so long. We see it being used in the 1840s, but you also see it being used by President McKinley as late as 1898 in the war with Spain. So it's one of those concepts that justifies conquest, and it justifies conquest in an almost messianic type of viewpoint, is what I would say.
So you said bring light to the West. How do the Indians fit into this picture?
Well, and this is, you know, this is what's very interesting because what we have is you have established cultures. You have obviously numerous tribes. If we go, if we think about the prehistory of the Americas, right? Yeah. We're talking about civilizations, the Pueblo civilizations, for example, in New Mexico, that are among the preeminent civilizations, ancient civilizations in the world, in fact. And so, what you have is you have at least a belief amongst many that the West is an underutilized virgin land that is not being actually taken full advantage of by the native tribes, and that is part of what justifies this spoliation, this expropriation of these lands on the part of settlers. In many respects, you have miners, frontiersmen, eventually farmers, so that this West is seen as the great, if you will, the great frontier, the golden land that the United States and its population can expand into.
Yeah, I was really interested. You referenced Karl May earlier in the kind of wet novels about the West that he writes for a German audience. But I was really intrigued by the discussion you had about where Americans found out about the West and the idea that they learned about them, certainly from newspapers, but also from novels and traveling shows.
Yeah, one of the most interesting areas that in looking at, one of the things I wanted to try to do in both cases was to see how is the idea, these imagined areas, because the West and the Nazi East are very much imagined areas. What I wanted to see, how is that idea of an imagined area sold to the American public? How is it propagated? In the dime novels, which are actually come out of this period, which was to me very fascinating to say what we would consider graphic novels, similar in respect to that, but they're used as kind of this popular culture to create this picture of, if you will, adventure, masculinity, and the idea that you have these individuals who go into this wild, untamed area by the standards of the books, and they do great deeds to, in other words, enrich themselves, but also enrich the areas. And it gets to this feeling of how people imagine and create ideas of these areas mm-hmm. themselves. And in that case, you have propaganda works both ways in terms of depictions of Native Americans and Native tribes. And James Fenimore Cooper, obviously, is this idea of the noble savage, but you also see the idea of the so-called ignoble savage. Mm-hmm. And you see you also see racial stereotyping of other groups to include Mexicans in this literature. But it's creating a sense of at least trying to create a sense of understanding that people can relate to the mm-hmm. West from a frame of their reference, mm-hmm. even to those who will never travel there. And that to me was fascinating, along with Buffalo Bill's exhibition, which again for many people and Europeans, quite frankly, because it travels internationally, becomes emblematic of the West. And obviously, it's a fiction mm-hmm. In many respects of the West, but those fictions become the realities that at least people at the time period accept.
So in the Nazi case, it seems to me at some point in time, that kind of the way in which these ideas spread changed from bottom up to top down, or at least the distribution between those two changed pretty significantly. I don't get the sense that ever really happened in the United States.
Yeah. One of the key distinctions, I think, and I think the way you worded it is a good one. The top down. If we look at the Nazi East, we have a racial-based ideology that sees the East as an area of not only opportunity, economic opportunity, but also as an area of, if you will, racial danger to the state. And that prescribes the actions, in many cases, something we'll talk about later. In the West, it's a little, there's the economic aspect drives, certainly, the expropriation, and that economic aspect is plain by settlers moving in, by miners moving in, by farmers and ranchers moving in and expropriating this property. And one of the interesting dynamics that I talk about in my mind in the book is there's a discussion between the role of the center and the periphery. And when I discuss that, what I mean is the center would be what we would consider to be the decision-making political center. In the United States, that would be the East Coast, Washington, Washington, D.C., but also the media markets of New York and Boston could be included in that. And the periphery would be the frontier itself. And when you look at the dynamic of what's going on, it's very interesting to see that during the Civil War period, we saw a sectional divide that was north-south, and especially in print, so newspapers kind of become the war of words before the actual war itself is played out there. In the West, you see a similar dynamic where it's now an east-west sectional dynamic where those on the East Coast, in many cases, you have reform groups that support the tribes, support them in terms of wanting them to be assimilated, Christianized, and become like, if you will, white society. And then you have in the West, you have another dynamic of those who are on the frontier who are actively engaged in expropriation and taking possession of that land, who talk about things like extermination, who advocate for extreme measures with respect to the various tribes in various areas. And so you have a very interesting periphery is trying to drive the policy, but in fact, in the American West, the East Coast, the political decision-making center, is often a break to those types of policies. And if we were to switch and think about Nazi Germany, it's very interesting. The center in that case would be in Berlin, and the periphery would be on the Eastern Front. And what we see in that case, though, is that the center has clearly talked about annihilation and genocide as being the marching orders. And on the periphery, there's no competition. It's how the competition involves how to most effectively to achieve those goals. And so you have a radicalizing dynamic that happens in the periphery that's supported by the center. And so for me, that was one of those, that was one of the most interesting parts of the comparison in looking at it.
A chapter then devoted to strategic thinking about the Indian Wars and of course about the Nazi period. And you mentioned a little bit that in some sense the American objective in the West was primarily economic, although there was lots of other things going on. What does that look like? To the Americans at the time, what does a victory look like? And on a strategic level, how do they imagine achieving it?
Yeah, and I think it's really important to note when I say primarily economic, and this is what I think is very important to stress, is that there are multiple acts of atrocity, mass murder, mm-hmm. injustice that accompany that economic spoliation, that expropriation of those areas. But I also think it's very important to understand that. That the native tribes have agency themselves, mm-hmm. and that agency is often effaced. If we look at, for example, in some of the literature that talks about native tribes as only being acted upon, right? Mm-hmm. And if we look at the Comanche Empire, for example, in Pekka Hamalainen's Comanche Empire, Brian DeLay's War of a Thousand Deserts are two works that look at this in detail. We see that Comancheria into the 1870s really is the preeminent force on the southern plains into Texas, all the way into Mexico, literally hundreds of miles into Mexico. And so what you see is you see a borderlands history where you have an active contestation, and there's more than simply those being acted upon and those acting. Now, the way I think to answer your question as to how the West or settlers saw this playing out would be that their end game was, if the native tribes could be placed on reservations that they did not want, in land that the Westerners did not want, and isolated there until they either assimilated or it became marginalized in this case, then they would take possession of that land. And that was, in their mind, I think, the end game, if you will. That's mm-hmm. what they sought, because you have these continuing waves of overland immigration mm-hmm. into the West at different times. And obviously the Civil War is a key watershed in that period, with the Homestead Act in 1862. We're making lands, the U.S. government's making lands available. You also have now continuing immigrant waves that are looking to move and to have land, and so it just brings this conflict, this period of what Elliot mm-hmm. West calls the Greater Reconstruction, which mm-hmm. involves not only the reincorporation of the American South back into the Union, but the incorporation now of the American West into this national project is part of that. But I do find it interesting, and I talk about this in the book, the anthropologist Lawrence Keeley talks about how after expropriation takes place, once the settlers have their land, then they're willing to become nostalgic about you know, Native Americans and Indian culture, right? But it's only after they become marginalized and no longer represent a threat to their interests, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's that's an interesting point. And again, in terms of comparison, if we go to the Nazi East, by the very nature, Jews were an existential threat as defined in Nazi racial ideology. Jews and Slavs, to a certain degree, were an existential threat to Germany, at least National Socialists, as they saw it. And so there was no accommodation, there was no area of marginalization, that it was not just about taking the land, but it was also about killing and taking their lives.
You mentioned this a little bit earlier. I wonder if you could say more about it, because you're right. It's notable. You don't see, and the evidence in the book shows that this seems to be true. You don't see annihilation as an actual strategic goal of these campaigns. But there's a lot of rhetoric that sounds like it, both from settlers on the ground, but also from army officers and political. How do you view this rhetoric?
Yeah, and there's to me is probably one of the most difficult questions in looking at the project, because this rhetoric is pretty ubiquitous, as you point out, and you see it on the behalf of leading generals, whether it's Sheridan, whether it's Phil Sheridan, whether it's William Tecumseh Sherman, or even U.S. Grant. But the idea that certainly I think one of the things that you look at 19th century U.S. history, the hard war of the Civil War, there's also this rhetoric of annihilation with respect to the South, right? And so in terms of the use of exterminationist rhetoric, it's certainly present in both areas. Now, for me, the question is then looking at how does it look like on the ground? So how is this rhetoric translated into actions? And what we – at least what I saw in going through many of these discussions or these comparisons was that rhetoric was often used, and it sometimes it's held as the most extreme, whether it's a newspaper or whether it's an army officer – talking about this, this is the most extreme thing that could happen. But then again, you see it that in reality, in practice, the idea is not to translate it to the most extreme, or that in many cases, that arguments that are proposed about extermination are either countered with moral arguments or, in some cases, economic arguments. For example, the Seminole Wars were the most expensive wars that the United States has ever fought relative to the resources at the time. And there are those who talk about extermination as being morally wrong, but also many who talk about it as being economically unfeasible. So, you know, you get these practical arguments as well. Certainly in the West, this rhetoric of extermination, those in closest contact, those seeking to take control of these resources are most adamant, I would argue, in the use of that rhetoric. And again, flipping back now to the Nazi East, this rhetoric that I talk about that Nazi generals use, that Hitler and Nazi bureaucrats use, we see it's actually, if we look at on the ground, we see that those policies are translated into mass annihilation, into genocide. And to me, that's an interesting dichotomy, how rhetoric can stand, because I think we're all, especially academics, we're very concerned about how rhetoric shapes an environment, right? Whether it's a political environment, it's certainly one of the things we're attuned to. And then looking at why that rhetoric is or is not necessarily transformed, if you will, into concrete actions is another, I think, interesting part of this comparison. And again, like I said, we see actions that are mass atrocities, that are mass murder, and I talk about those. But what tends to happen is they're used in terms of military strategy, pursue and punish or chastise. So the idea is, well, if we kill 200 of the Piegans in 1870, an Indian tribe in Montana and on the Northern Plains, what we'll see is the idea is, well, that will serve to act as a signal to the other tribes of the area not to engage in depredations, not to engage in raiding, whatever the case might be here. But there's no plan to say, okay, what we need to do is we need to annihilate all these tribes in order to take possession of this area. That to me is one of the things that came out of that discussion, the nuance or complexity of some of those discussions.
Yeah, I was really interested in this, and that the sense in which violence, and not just violence against men, but often directed especially at men, but also women and children, is conceived in both cases as a signaling device. In the German case, it's not conceived that way with Jews, but it might be conceived that way against the resistance in Ukraine or Belarus or certainly in Serbia. It's a kind of a rational tactic toward a rational end.
Yeah, no, I think that, and I think that your distinction there is a good one. When we do look at German occupation policy in the East, looking at indigenous areas, very much goes between two extremes. One of the extremes is the so-called dead zone, creation of dead zones, which literally means in partisan areas or suspected partisan areas to go into villages and towns and literally wipe out, raise the towns, take the livestock, take any foodstuffs, and then kill the populations, or, as you're talking about, to have graduated kind of actions against local populations designed to prevent them from supporting the partisans. And there's a tension in Nazi ideology between those two extremes. I think what we see in the Nazi East that ultimately, because the campaign is based on this idea of racial ideas, that it ultimately leads to the radicalization of policy, especially near the end of the war, as the German front is collapsing. But there are some attempts at somewhat signaling or accommodation, as you mentioned. But the underlying premise, again, is that that area is going to be Germanized, which means for tens of millions of individuals, they're going to lose their lives. And I think that that's one of the things that when you talk about Serbia, 1.7 million Serbians lose their lives. And I think a lot of people don't think about those numbers in Serbia, right? A relatively small area, right? But we start looking at Poland, and it's 6 million, you know, 3 million Polish Jews, but 3 million Polish Christians or Gentiles are killed in Poland. Tens of millions, right, are killed in Eastern Europe. And when we start to think about the level and the scale and the scope of that kind of killing, I think that that's one of, to me, that's also one of the distinctions that comes out in the comparison.
Yeah, let's kind of keep teasing at this idea of massacres for a minute, because one of the things I found notable in your book is your description of kind of the tactical imperatives of war in the West here in America, and the idea that one of the adaptations the army made to their fairly consistent inability to catch Indians on the move was to surround villages or to overlook villages and attack first thing in the morning to gain surprise. And the almost inevitable result of that is that you're going to be killing or wounding women and children as well as combatants.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where you see where the signaling comes in. And also what you see is the idea here, this is where a racial idea is also present, that somehow that this is the type, and I talk about the generals who see the only thing that native tribes really understand, the only thing the Indians really understand is the firm hand, this level of violence. And it is really a tactic, if you will, in many cases of the weak, because it gets back to one of the strengths of Indian warfare. You have these large columns of U.S. Cavalry and infantry, and these plans for converging columns, whether it's to chase Geronimo and the Apache in the southwest or to operate on the northern or southern plains. And what you see very quickly and what the army recognizes very quickly is they can march literally for hundreds or thousands of miles and come away empty. So the idea is because the native tribes are so much more adept at knowing the terrain, at recognizing when these large columns are coming in, that they're able to pick and choose when and how they want to engage the army, the U.S. Army especially. Now, one of the interesting parts of this that I talk about in the book is that, in fact, what the U.S. Army does to counterbalance this is it brings in numerous scouts and auxiliaries from the native tribes themselves. And what we have to remember is, for example, there is great enmity between certain tribes, whether it's Ute and Navajo, for example, Comanche and a number of tribes because of the power of the Comanche themselves. But on the northern plains, for example, the Crow versus the Sioux versus the Shoshone. And so what the U.S. Army is able to do often is to take advantage of native martial skills by incorporating these other tribal members into the U.S. Army structure to be successful. But that might allow them, for example, to be able to then tactical success in actually surrounding a village, as I talk about with the Marias River Massacre, as I talk about at Slim Buttes and some of the other areas. The Battle of Turret Mountain would be another one. In battle, in quotation marks, in that case. But the other thing that I would point out is what Sheridan, what George Crook, these are U.S. Army generals, Nelson Miles, what they come to realize is that really because they can't capture, they can't capture the native tribes, if they can chase them, not only during the summer months, but if they can continue to chase these tribes during the winter, what they can essentially do is they won't capture the tribe itself, but they'll capture villages. They destroy the infrastructure. They destroy the supplies. They destroy the teepees, the buffalo ropes. And so now what you have is you have these tribal groups that are now cut off, literally, from sustenance and lodging during the winter. And what that then facilitates is a process of driving these various native tribes onto the reservation where they are protected in terms of they won't be they won't be attacked in those terms. So this larger, there's this tactical signaling that you talked about in these engagements, but there's this larger engagement of literally exhausting exhausting the tribes and eventually driving. Driving the tribes onto the reservation, which is an interesting dynamic because once they get to the reservations, and many times the reservations are completely unprepared to provide the tools, the annuities, the sustenance that the tribes need. And so for many of those, and I talked about this in the book, whether it's Crazy Horse or Sitting Bull or Geronimo, or Victoria, or whoever we're talking about, these Indian leaders, coming out of a martial culture, they're put in a position where they either starve on the reservation and they lose their cultural and ethnic identity, or they have to go raiding. They have to go. They have to assert their military power in that way. And so, the tragedy in many respects of this story is. How these tribes and groups are not only are put into this untenable situation, but that how they're not even given the tools to try to create a desirable outcome, and that gets to a great deal of tension between the Army and the Interior Department, which is in charge of Indian policy after 1849. So these are again, as you point out, some of the complexities of this story. That in my mind make it so fascinating.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, of course, the Nazis briefly imagine a kind of reservation, maybe not system, but strategy, and then they quickly abandon it.
Yeah, in the case of the Lublin Reservation, which is obviously when they take over Poland in 1939, there are portions of Western Poland that are incorporated into the German Reich, the so-called Old Reich, but the general government is created as kind of really itself as a giant reservation area for Poles and Jews. Mm-hmm. And within the general government, there's a plan that comes up, the Lublin Reservation, which comes up as an idea. It's going to become, it's this swampy area where it's going to become a dumping ground for Polish Jews, and literally what's going to happen is they're going to be left there with nothing. And the idea behind that is in the Nazi mentality, well, they're disease carriers anyway. This is going to lead to their decimation on their own. And even in the case of where the Nazis consider the so-called Madagascar plan, which is a plan to literally transport European Jews off the east coast of Africa to Madagascar. So the idea is not that they're just going to take Jews there and leave them there. They're going to be in a large concentration camp. So even in that case, right, there's this idea that this isolation is also going to be an isolation that is going to lead somehow to decimation. And I don't believe in the reservations, for all their faults, and there are many, and it depends in many cases on the Indian agents and the superintendents who are put in charge. It depends on whether Congress appropriated annuities and they're delivered or not. They were not seen as sites of extinction necessarily, but certainly they were. They share the idea of sites of isolation and marginalization in that in those terms.
The other way, so the other thing I found interesting about the idea of massacres in your book was the sense in which, at least as I understood your argument, many of the massacres, not all, but many of the massacres in the American West happened or involved non-professional military, whether they were vigilantes or temporary soldiers or state militias. These are the people who tend to, or these soldiers tend to be more extreme in their conduct than the professional military.
No, that's I'm glad you brought that that point up, because I think when we look at, one of the things I try to do is look at who are the actors involved in the killing in both areas. And the point is, if we look at Amy Greenberg's A Wicked War, which talks about the Mexican-American War, many of those forces, right, are not regular army forces. These are volunteer forces from the states. Even the Texas Rangers, who become involved, another paramilitary force, if you will, in the war with Mexico. And the widespread acts of atrocity that are associated with volunteer and militia forces is something we already see in that war. In fact, the Texas Rangers get sent back to Texas due to that. But what you also see in the West is with Chivington, and I talked about the Sand Creek massacre in 1864, these Colorado volunteers, and they're on a 100-day enlistment, and Governor Evans in the Colorado Territory says he wants to build this this volunteer group, and its purpose is to kill Indians. Now, what's interesting to me about that is in 1864, the regular army and the eyes of the nation are focused on the Civil War and the events there. And we see that when Western policy is left to the devices of Western governors and of Western groups, we see that these volunteers, frontiersmen, are most adept and most ready to employ exterminative warfare as their template for actions. And on many cases in the book, I talk about where in the West, either governors or newspapers will say, well, we don't need the U.S. Army here. What we need is we need to bring in the volunteers, the frontiersmen, because they're the ones who can most effectively deal with this threat. And what they mean by that is mass killing and annihilation.
So you come down clearly on in the argument that American policy was not aimed to physically destroy the native population. But as I read your book, it seems fairly clear that at least much of the American population sees the eventual destiny, if things go right, of the Indians as assimilating into American cultures and structures. And you talk a little bit at the beginning of the book about definitions of genocide and the idea of cultural genocide. So am I right in thinking that you would come down and say there's at least some tendency toward a genocidal, a cultural genocidal impulse in this?
I think definitely if the definition in Raphael Lemkin, in his initial definition before UN Resolution 260, on the prevention and punishment of the crime of genocide was passed by the UN in 1948. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Lemkin felt that cultural genocide was a type of genocide.
Yeah.
It is not something that was incorporated into Resolution 260, just like political genocide. We talk about the Soviet Union, the Kulaks, for example, was not incorporated into the official definition of genocide. If one accepts the premise that there is such a thing as cultural genocide or cultural asphyxiation, I think absolutely then it would qualify. What is absolutely clear in my mind is that there was little or no room for Native tribes to maintain their ethnic identities in the American project. And so the idea was, and this is a cultural bias then, the idea was an ethnocentrism, if you will, that the tribes had to, in order to join the so-called American project, they had to change. And the only way that they could change and be successful in that project was by becoming farmers, by becoming members of this white society. And so that was the stark reality that they were faced with. And it does raise an interesting question with respect to how we think about what genocide is, but even more, what are the costs? What were the costs of that forced assimilation? I think, and in the book, I talk about a quote from Wilma Mankiller, who was a principal tribe of the Cherokee Nation, and she described the Trail of Tears as "quote unquote" our Holocaust or the Cherokee Holocaust, and clearly from a Native American perspective, right? I think that it's very clear that to see the events that happened to specific tribes in this process of forced assimilation from their perspective would very much fit into that overall paradigm of genocide.
So for and just as an aside for listeners who are new to the program, if you're interested in the subject, I interviewed Andrew Wolford a year or so ago about his books about the residential schools, and so you can go back at the website and look at that. So we're nearing the end of our time. I'd like you to do kind of a two or three kind of broader comparisons, and the first is to say, looking at both cases and rhetoric, and I know this is kind of vastly simplifying. But in one of your case studies, the Nazis used exterminatory rhetoric and meant it. In the American case study, you get a lot of rhetoric about annihilation and extermination, but the behavior on the ground doesn't necessarily and often doesn't actually live up to that kind of rhetoric. So how do you go about evaluating that kind of rhetorical extremism?
Well, I think what you have to look at is, and this is where the comparison itself, in a totalitarian regime, if the rhetoric is coming from the top, then it has its ability to, and it's being supported by a state apparatus, it can in fact be transformed into action. But what we see in the American West, in my mind, is there's multiple, it's not only the center versus periphery, but there's multiple centers of power and checks in the U.S. East, whether it's Congress, whether it's Indian agents themselves, in some cases U.S. Army units that are on the ground and can prevent rhetoric from being turned into actual reality. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you see with rhetoric is when the institutions can be aligned in pursuit of a common goal, that's when it becomes most dangerous and most feasible.
I would say that was actually my next question, to ask you to revisit that issue of center and periphery. And one of the challenges, of course, in this is assessing this as it happens and evaluating in a kind of complicated media environment, trying to figure out what's happening, for instance, in Syria or the Sudan, and kind of making those assessments.
Well, and you know, and you're right. And the other thing, it comes to political will, right? And I mean, we see this you know, certainly news from the U.S. West back to the East, it takes time in the 19th yeah. century, right? And for me, one of the interesting anecdotes or interesting stories that I had is after the Battle of Little Bighorn and Custer's force mm-hmm. is annihilated, you have the 5th Cavalry, and they're watching in the Nebraska Territory as a group of Cheyenne, 1,000 Cheyenne, are leaving to go join Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse's forces literally about a month after the massacre. And the 5th Army is strung out and with orders to prevent them from leaving and force them back to the reservation. And in my mind, this is a case where you would think that that's a perfect situation for a genocidal kind of massacre of those, mm-hmm. You know, the army's angry about what happened. Here you have this long trail of men, women, and children that are leaving the mm-hmm. reservation. And in fact, what it leads to is literally forcing them back to the reservation mm-hmm. with one casualty, as I talk about in the book. But the point there seems to me again we see that in this case there are other factors that influence actions yeah. on the ground. In Nazi Germany, all those factors from the top down to the bottom are aimed at annihilation essentially, yeah. and that's what really becomes a defining difference.
Yeah, and so you started this by talking about Hitler's reference in Karl May and this sense in which Hitler was at least aware of the wars against the Indians. He makes similar comments. The exact comment, the wording of them is not entirely sure, but he at least refers to Armenia. Talks about, well, nobody really cared about Armenians. I guess I can do what I want. How much do you think these kind of historical examples really mattered in terms of outlining his act or determining his actions?
You know, I guess for me, what was interesting was you think about what people imagine. What mm-hmm. it's less of what's true in many cases as what people believe is true. And so if Hitler believed that the American West was conquered by millions, literally, of Indians being shot down, as he talked about, or that the world was not concerned about the Armenian genocide, I think it tells us less about those historical events than how Hitler himself envisioned what he could do in the mm-hmm. East and what he felt he could get away with in the East. So it tells you more about Hitler, I think, in this case, than it does about U.S. history. But that to me is the important part. If he could imagine that happening that way, then that in his mind could serve mm-hmm. as the template for his own actions in the East.
Well, I've used a lot of your time, and I want to say thanks so much for your time. For the listeners who are interested in pursuing it, the book's got lots of good information. It's very interesting, and Ed writes really well, so it reads quickly. Just as a way of concluding, I think I'm trying hard not to count how many days left I have on break because it's just discouraging. But I got a few, and I always ask guests to suggest a book or two they've read or a movie they've watched. What should I read this weekend before I turn my attention to syllabi?
Well, I'll tell you, I'd give you several. I talk about Brian DeLay's War of a Thousand Deserts, which is published by Yale, which is a mm-hmm. fantastic look at the Comanche Empire and what mm-hmm. happens to northern Mexico as a result of Comanche martial strength. Another book that I came across that is fascinating to me was Kevin Mulroy's Freedom on the Border. And it deals with escaped slaves who go into Florida and they become part of the Seminole tribe, the so-called Seminole Maroons, who then during removal go into the Indian Territory, today's Oklahoma, who are then contracted by the Mexican government to come into northern Mexico and serve as a bulwark against Indian raiding, because they themselves understand it, who then migrate into Texas and become scouts for the U.S. Army. And when we talk about identity, identity and how it's changed and how it's negotiated, to me, that's fascinating. On the German side, I think Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands, which looks at Eastern Europe from a Soviet perspective, and what happens during the Soviet period and the Nazi period, is interesting because one of the things that I have found most interesting is this whole idea of borderlands and borderlands history. Because the borderlands aren't only in the Southwest, they're also in Eastern Europe, they are around the world, and how these borderlands histories, how peoples and civilizations come into contact and conflict, to me is a fascinating part.
We didn't get a chance to talk about that, and we're out of time now, but I will just say for listeners, Ed has some really interesting things to say about that in his book, and it's well worth looking at. I'm not sure I can quite manage three books over the next 3 days, but I will give it a shot. If my wife ends up hating me, I'll blame you. Last question is one I always ask. What are you working on now?
Well, my new project focuses on the role of alcohol and atrocity. So I'm looking at how alcohol was used, and I started with the Holocaust and looking at both German units, to include military and paramilitary SS and police. But if we look at, for example, Rwanda, alcohol, machete season, Jan Hatzfeld's Machete Season talks about these cabarets, the sites of planning, celebration, drinking. To me, this is a fascinating topic that incorporates not only historical but also sociological, psychological studies, masculinity studies in some parts are part of this. And so I'm fascinated at looking at this interrelationship between how alcohol and its use can also be tied to functions of a mass atrocity.
Interesting. Yeah, this is a timely topic. There's this new book that this German author has written, whose name I'm not remembering, about the drug use. And I think the headline of this is Hitler's drug use, but what I thought was more interesting was the drug use in the Wehrmacht.
Yeah.
So, well, it sounds like a great project, and I hope when you're done you'll come back on the show to talk about it. But I want to say thanks again for having time to talk with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Kelly. I appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to an interview with Edward Westerman about his new book, Hitler's Ostkrieg and the Indian Wars, Comparing Genocide and Conquest, published by the University of Oklahoma Press. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join us next time when I'll interview Rebecca Jinks about her book, Representing Genocide, The Holocaust as Paradigm. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great one.